Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
And just before we start, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on this land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. Thank you for joining us and tuning in to the program this morning. Also, if you're tuning in around the country, thank you for joining us. You're listening via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And also, if you're around the world tuning in as well, we get our regular listeners from around the world tuning in. On the program with me this morning, I have Myra Johnson, and Myra has a special guest all the way from the United States of America. Just before we start, Myra, and just before we bring Ankh in, could you tell us your name and your country, please, sis?
My name is Myra Johnson. Hello, greetings. I'm from Central Queensland, part of the Wurdi-speaking people, part of the Wanganajagalingu Traditional Owners Family Council, fighting against the Adani Carmichael coal mine.
And I guess for our listeners, just to recap, Myra has been on the program before, and like she just said in the introduction, where she's from, they've been heading up a massive big fight against Adani and this massive big coal mine that the state government and also the federal government wants to support to put in. And we've had, Myra and Uncle Adrian and other people from the fight on the radio with us as well. Over the last week or so, they've had international guests from around the world join them. Myra, just really quickly, could you tell us that event?
Over the last week, we've, at the University of Queensland through the Global Change Institute, in partnership with the Wanganajagalingu Family Council, we've been able to host an international land justice symposium, bringing together guests from the major colonial settler states. So America tried to get somebody from Canada at the last minute. They had to pull out and stay home, but Australia and New Zealand as well. And just looking at the commonality in the history of colonial settler occupation in our traditional lands, and also what we're doing to combat that and combat extractive industries that working against Indigenous people and against everybody in our lands as well. So here on the show we have very, very special guest, honoured to have him make the journey all the way over at short notice, Uncle Walter Echo Hawk. And I'll just let him introduce himself a bit too.
Well, hello. My name, as you mentioned, is Walter Echo Hawk, and I am a Pawnee Indian from the Great Plains of North America in the United States. I belong to the Kitkahaki band of the Pawnee Nation, and my tribal name is Arusa Turahe, which means good horse, and I've been an Indigenous rights attorney since 1973 down to the present day in the United States, representing Indian nations and traditional religious leaders, as well as some of our hunters, fishers, and gatherers, as well as serving as a tribal judge. And then in recent years, I've served as a law professor, as well as a book writer, an author.
Mm. Yeah.
And I'm just so very honored and pleased to come to Australia and participate in this symposium to look at our comparative problems that we have as Indigenous peoples that live, I think, in the hardcore settler states, former British colonies that are the progenies of those colonies, in the world today, and I've been very blessed to be here. I've always wanted to come to Australia, and of course the Aboriginal peoples are very, very world-renowned people, and I'm very honored, to be here and to listen to the words of wisdom and the aspirations of the Aboriginal peoples here, and I'm just very moved, by the very ancient and venerable and cultures here in this mm-hmm. part of the yeah. world, you know, so it's yeah. certainly my honor to be here.
Mm-hmm. And in your introduction, you did say, like, you've been, obviously as Indigenous peoples, you know, we're involved in, I guess, the struggle against colonialism, you know, since the day we're born, but you said since 73 you've pretty much been a very, very active person supporting other Indigenous peoples. That was a pretty hostile times and also like revolutionary times for lots of people in the United States. You know, you had the rise of the Black Panthers, mm-hmm. The Chicano movement, and then also you had the at AIM as well. Yes, yes. You know, how important is it to sort of look back at those times as well? You know, I guess the beginnings of a lot of things. You know, for I guess the future generations today.
Yes, I think I was born in a very historic time in the United States, and went to law school in 1970 and graduated in 1973, and that was a very historic time in the United States because in 1970 President Nixon handed down a brand new indigenous policy called the Indian Self-Determination Policy, which radically departed from prior federal policies of enforced assimilation, termination, to move to self-determination, which was the federal policy to empower the Indian tribes to determine their own destinies, you know, to make decisions to affect the aspirations of tribal people. But back in 1970, it was simply a policy, and it remained to be implemented throughout the land. And so my generation of young people and young tribal leaders at that time was to implement that policy. And so that created a social movement called the Tribal Sovereignty Movement in the United States, which today, two generations later, looking back on those decades, we really witnessed one of the great American social movements, this Tribal Sovereignty Movement that ranks alongside of the Black Civil Rights Movement, the Women's Movement, the Environmental Movement as one of America's great social movements. And through the work of these two generations, a committed race of American Indians, their tribal leaders, a growing number of indigenous attorneys, we have really witnessed the rise of our modern Indian nations in the United States, so that today we can look around in the United States and see 560 full-service governments, tribal governments, that not only conduct self-government, but also run tribal colleges and tribal museums, police forces, fire departments, rangers, as well as you know, having our own court systems that are all an integral part of the domestic political system now in the United States. We have a lot of other problems, work and challenges, and grave problems today in the Trump era, but we've certainly come a long way in this tribal sovereignty movement. And during that period, I had the wonderful privilege and opportunity, you know, to as a staff attorney with the Native American Rights Fund, which was the premier Native American legal organization, a Native interest legal organization, to travel our country and visit and represent indigenous peoples in their tribal habitats on a wide variety of legal issues, land claims, treaty rights, prisoner rights, religious freedom, repatriation rights, and work with some of our very profound medicine people, spiritual leaders, as well as political leaders. We have our own Nelson Mandelas and Martin Luther Kings, only they wear braids and blue jeans, you know, to represent them in the issues that they faced and continue to face, which are very, very similar to the issues that your peoples face, you know, here in Australia, you know, very common histories of colonialism and very, very common set of aspirations. And so I had a very unique legal career, and very thankful that I've had the opportunity, you know, to represent, you know, our tribal people in Native North America,
and in different fields as well. Like you did mention as well. You know, you said you were a Native judge.
Yes, tribal judge.
Tribal judge. Sorry. And I guess, yeah, like you've been over here for almost a week now. You know, you spoke at the symposium that Mara just spoke about, and you did mention, you know, the commonalities and the similarities that we have as Indigenous peoples from colonialism that, you know, are still stuck on, you know, Indigenous peoples. How do you see, you know, the fight against Adani, you know, coming over here and visiting and yarning with some of these mobs, and compared to some of the stuff, some of the movements back home as well?
Well, I think that the need for the WNJ peoples to defend their homeland from this largest strip coal mining project in the Southern Hemisphere is not a localized quirk of some kind, but rather it represents in the larger struggle of Indigenous peoples worldwide, you know, some 350 million Indigenous peoples residing in habitats in over close to 90 nations around the world. It's a universal problem, these massive extraction industries coming into remote Indigenous areas and running roughshod over the people in search of natural resources, you know, that would make our lives and our cultures expendable, you know, and to snuff out, you know, the very precious, irreplaceable world's Indigenous cultures, you know, and so this is a very, it's a common universal problem faced by Native peoples around the world. And to me, it's a quite serious problem here with this Carmichael mine, you know, that threatens to snuff out.
Yeah.
A very precious Indigenous Aboriginal way of life here, you know, which is not, should not be treated as expendable. So it's a very serious life and death, I think, kind of a struggle, a David versus Goliath kind of a struggle. We see that in the United States. We have some reservations like the Northern Cheyenne Reservation that are just literally next door to massive coal mine operations, the same way with the Navajo or Dene Reservation, big strip mining as well as uranium mining, you know, and it's just there's also this element of environmental justice at play here too, because these kinds of development, including fracking, are always seem to be put in Indigenous communities rather than in the backyards of our affluent non-Aboriginal neighbors, you know. And so I commend the vitality of the WNJ peoples for standing up to that, to taking a warrior's stance and doing what they have to do, because they really have no choice but to protect the land as the Aboriginal stewards, and the relationships that they have with the animals and the plants and the water of that area, you know, which is misunderstood by a lot of the mainstream people. They just don't have those kinds of connections to the land and the land ethics and values about how we should comport ourselves to the natural world are as old as the human race, but our modern industrial society has lost touch with that, you know, and simply don't understand, you know, really what is at stake between the people and the land.
And you did, I just want to touch on what you said before about, you know, how they always seem to put it in significant places for Indigenous peoples. And over the last few years, I guess it was one of the biggest, I guess, social movements that sort of, you know, brought people from all around the world, and that's talking about Standing Rock. You know, they wanted to put the pipeline straight through a burial site, I believe it was, or it might be, you know, for almost six or seven months or more, they held this pipeline, which sort of pushed the former President Obama to sort of put a halt on, you know, any sort of movement for this pipeline. And as soon as one of the first things Donald Trump does was come in and he signs like an amendment to sort of change this, and the pipeline goes through. And then, you know, not so long after, you know, we hear about a spill that happens. You know, this is all too often when we hear, you know, mobs, you know, putting a halt to, you know, these pipelines. You know, and then there's always this justification that it's never going to crack. It's never going to pollute the land.
The because a pipeline is a human artifact, it's really by definition an oil spill waiting to happen. You can count on it spilling at some point. What we witnessed on the Standing Rock, and which is about 600 or 700 miles north of where people live. Was a wake-up call, an awakening of our native people, because in recent years there's been a contagion of pipelines being built all over the United States. And this one would cross the Missouri River, which in our language is Kitswaruksti, the holy river, you know, polluting everything downstream, the water supply for the Standing Rock people that live just immediately downstream from there. A very miraculous thing took place there, you know, a very spiritual encampment where it started small, and then native peoples from all over America and other nations as well congregated in a great spiritual encampment, you know. It rose to about 10,000 people, and that throughout that encampment, I didn't go up there, but my son went up there. My brother, cousin, went up there as a veteran. Our chiefs, we had two or three chiefs that went up there along with the president of our tribal government. We brought our encampment brought our flag, and we marched through the snow, you know, with the our Sioux Nation brothers up there, sisters, witnessed a remarkable resurgence of the spiritual connection that our young people primarily, and left me with the feeling that our future is in very good hands, you know, with the young people. It shows that they listen to their elders and they learn from them, and that they're ready to do what is necessary to defend our habitats up there, places where we live. And it's true that under the Obama administration, we were able to kill off that Black Snake project.
Mm.
And then within a week or two, probably I think it was the first week of the
yeah.
Trump administration, he undid all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he approved also the Keystone XL pipeline coming through from Canada, too.
Yep.
Mm. And we live in a very rapacious time now in America under the Trump administration. He appointed a guy named Scott Pruitt who was the former Attorney General of the state of Oklahoma to be the EPA administrator, which is in charge of all of our environmental laws, environmental enforcement. And he's bought and sold by big oil, you know, and he immediately came in and dismantled all of the environmental protections that we do have to pave the way for just flat-out resource exploitation of our Arctic oceans, of our national monuments, the sacred Bear's Ears, a national monument, removing all regulatory impediments for clean air, clean water, unleashing unbridled fracking across the land, and setting back the environmental movement back to ground zero, you know. And so it's a very frightening time, you know, to see that on the environmental side. And as you mentioned earlier, when we were visiting earlier, you know, about the mistreatment of our immigrants that are trying to, brown people that are trying to immigrate to America from United States, from Central and South America, putting the kids in cages and things of this nature against a background of abject racial rhetoric, you know, by people from espoused from by officials in high places, you know. It seems like it's sort of a last stand of white privilege being made in the United States because against the browning of America, because the Caucasian race is projected to become a minority group here in about 5 or 6 years, you know. And so I think that what some of the underlying forces at work there is the fears harbored by, you know, some of the Caucasians not wanting to be a minority group because they know how they've treated minorities.
Mm. On the program with me this morning, I have Mara Johnson, and Mara has a special guest all the way from the United States of America.
Gather around, people, I tell your story, an 8-year long story, power and pride, the British Lord Vesty, Vincent Lingari, were opposite men on opposite sides.
Vesty was fat, with money and muscle. Beef was his business, broad was his door. Vincent was lean, spoke very little. He had no bank balance, hard dirt was his floor.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Gurindji were working, nothing but rations. Once they had gathered the wealth of the land, daily depression got tighter and tighter. Gurindji decided they must make a stand.
They picked up their swags, started off walking at Wadi Creek. They sat themselves down. Now it don't sound like much, but it sure got tongues talking back at the homestead and then in the town.
From big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Vesty man said, I double your wages. 7 quid a week you have in your hand. Vincent said, we're not talking about wages. We're sitting right here till we get our land.
Vesty man roared, Vesty man thundered. You don't stand a chance of a cinder in snow. Vincent, if we fall, others are rising.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Then Vincent Lingyari, he boarded an airplane, landed in Sydney, big city of lights. Daily he went round, softly speaking his story to all kinds of men from all walks of life.
Vincent sat down with every big politicians. This affair, they told him, it's a matter of state. Let us sort it out. Why are people hungry? Vincent said, no thanks, we know how to wait.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Then Vincent Lingyari returned in an airplane to his country, once more to sit down. He told his people, let the stars keep on turning. We have friends in the south, in the cities and towns.
Eight years went by, eight long years of waiting, to one day a tall stranger appeared in the land. And he came with lawyers, came with great ceremony, through Vincent's fingers poured a handful of sand.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. That was the story of Vincent Lingyari. This is the story of something much more. Our power and privilege cannot move a people who know where they stand, and they stand in their law. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
On the program with me this morning, I have Myra Johnson, and Myra has a special guest all the way from the United States of America.
So here on the show, we have a guest, very, very special guest, very honoured to have him make the journey all the way over at short notice, Uncle Walter Echo Hawk.
One thing I wanted to sort of bring back and sort of bring Myra into this as well, like you did mention the importance of young people stepping up and, you know, like, just absorbing all this knowledge, and also, you know, you spoke about some of the EPA sort of government bought people back in the States. Is this sort of something, you know, like you've run into as well with, you know, this big fight against Adani?
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things that was clearest to me is that where coal is at the moment, and the decline in the mining boom that has happened that has caused so many people to lose their jobs is the fact that the governments, rather than thinking about, you know, the future, they're just thinking about this term and how they're going to get re-elected.
Mm.
Rather than being inventive and creative and looking at building security for their constituents, they're willing to, you know, beat a dead horse and kind of force industries and economies onto communities that don't want these industries or economies anymore, or simply they're just not able to hold communities up anymore. And I think one of the clearest things to me was the fact that we had the Prime Minister of Australia fly to India to meet with Gautam Adani and say that he was going to fix the native title problem. And by him saying that, he was saying he was going to fix the Wangan and Jagalingu problem and he was going to move us out of the way. And that was through, by way of mid last year, passing amendments that undid the McGlade decision of the Noongar people over in Western Australia. And so it's very clear that these things happen. We had an environment minister, Greg Hunt, who flew over the Galilee Basin and said, oh, there's nothing there. We have water, sacred water there, that has not stopped running since the beginning of time. But apparently there's nothing there. And so we come up all the time against people that are willing to bend over backwards for these projects where, although it doesn't fit right with the community and they think it wins them votes, but it really doesn't. Either way, they're always so willing to have us, the Indigenous people, as the collateral, which is to throw away people. And I had a member of the Palaszczuk government a couple of years ago, they're not in there anymore, whisper to me in a quiet hallway, oh, don't worry about fighting it, it's never going to go ahead. So we're just supposed to let them ride roughshod over our rights and allow for our decisions as people. Four times we've said no to mean nothing, and they expect us to not fight for those things to be respected and for people to understand that we've made a decision and we want that decision to stand and mean something. To have members of state government say that to us, oh, don't worry about fighting it, don't worry, we won't let it go ahead, but at the same time allowing our rights to be trampled and asking us to not fight back and allow our rights to be trampled, I think just speaks to, yeah, the situation that we're in, the situation that Indigenous peoples all around the world are in as well.
And like you did mention before, you know, like when we always hear these, you know, these mining companies, you know, wanting to come into Indigenous communities anywhere all over the world, you know, the first thing they throw is, oh, now it's going to create a local economy. But the majority of the time, it's always like fly flow, you know, fly in, fly out people, non-Indigenous peoples. Or if they are Indigenous, they're from other communities and it's not really, you know, building the economy for that community. And also, you know, there's that impact that it would have, you know, on those communities as well. You know, We hear stories as well. You know, this is one of the many ways that, you know, drugs and illicit drugs get into communities is through, you know, like these mining companies and this, you know, like new highways, you know, that they create for these communities. So there's more destruction that sort of comes into play when we talk about the opening of, you know, these communities to these multinational companies.
Mm-hmm. I think definitely. Like, my mom comes from a community in central Queensland that is surrounded on all sides by mining.
Which one's
by that? Coal mining, Warrabinda. And, like, the community, it's beautiful, you know. I love going back there and I love spending time with my family there. At the same time, so the community has completely transformed since I was a little girl and we used to spend holidays there all the time. And I try and go back at least once a year, but and I don't know if you could put that down to the mines being around, because at the same time we still face incredibly incredibly complex political and socioeconomic issues that I think are going to stay with us until we're actually able to build ourselves up and nation build for ourselves. But I think I put that transformation down to the might of our people and the time that they've put into community and trying to build it up. But at the same time, being surrounded by minds, they're just trying to hold them off now. Like, there's a new proposal all the time. And as much as the mining industry is in a decline, there's still a new proposal on the table, you know, every month or every couple of weeks. And so... I definitely find with the and it's an issue I think in North America as well, the uptake of new drug use that, you know, hasn't for a long time been common in our communities. I think there's definitely more research that needs to be done and looking at what is actually brought into our communities with these fly-in, fly-out workers and what these industries actually did to our communities. Because I don't know one community that's been actually better off for having a mine right next door. I don't know one, and I cannot name you one.
I think that's also true in the United States. The impact of these coal mines on communities is to basically destabilize their existing economies and social life. Just the people that from here should go to Appalachia in the United States, which has had a long history of coal mines. But if you go to those communities, there's not one single solitary community you can find in the United States that's well off, that's a coal mining community. Mm-hmm. What you'll find there is abject poverty, coal-related diseases, and all sorts of drug use. They do not improve the life and or economy or well-being of those communities. They're all trashed communities that have been viewed as expendable communities and expendable people. And if you can't find any of these so-called improved communities as a result of a coal mine, not to mention the adverse environmental impact, this is the dirtiest possible energy business that you can think of at a time of global warming, when the rest of the world is running swiftly as they can towards clean energy. To have the world's largest coal mine in the Southern Hemisphere is out of step with the modern world and the ethics that we're trying to have to save the human race and life as we know it from a global warming caused by coal mining and its related industry. So it just seems to be almost indefensible from a social standpoint, indefensible from an environmental standpoint, and indefensible from a human rights standpoint as far as the impact on vulnerable, small and very vulnerable indigenous communities. So,
yeah, and I think the only time it'll never be seen as a problem, and it'll never happen, you know, if they, you know, decide to, put mineral licenses on places like Beverly Hills or, you know, some rich communities here in Australia, you know, North Shore and Sydney, you know, like these are the only times when it becomes a problem, is because it's not that it's in the sight of people, it's just the fact that it's, you know, it's hurting white people's feelings, you know. Like it's you know, it's a problem when it's a problem for them. It's not a problem for them when it affects anybody bar them. And this is something that we continue to see all the time.
That goes back to the fundamental question of environmental justice. You know, where you would never put a mine of this nature in an affluent white community. It would be unheard of. You know, and so there is that element. An invidious, discriminatory aspect of development, and where it's only done in remote indigenous areas, basically.
And another thing it does, it also prices the people out of the area as well, out of, you know, indigenous communities, you know, and it makes it more harder for people to go back home, and visit family because the flights are too much. It's too much to get on the bus or the train to go back to these communities. I guess just in wrapping up, you want to say something, Cisco?
Yeah, just one more point is that it's also it's denigrating in the way that communities that are affected by these projects and this sort of business are always asked to argue for and explain their humanity in order to have their concerns heard. Mm. And a lot of times those concerns fall on deaf ears. But at the same time, I think it's a lot of labor and a lot of emotional exercise put as extra pressure onto small Indigenous vulnerable communities when we're asked to also
survive,
defend our humanity in order for people to simply understand that this is a project or this is something that is not going to be beneficial or helpful in any way or even neutral. For our communities, it's going to have disastrous impacts and disastrous effects way into the future for future generations as well.
Oh, definitely, of course. And just in wrapping up, from the both of you as well, why is it important, that we sort of have this international, cross-cultural sort of Indigenous gathering, building between our peoples? And this goes back to something that, Indigenous peoples continue to do. For the beginning of time, has always have this cross-cultural sort of understanding between ourselves. Why is it important, I guess, on an aspect like defending country or, in the context of Indigenous peoples today in, at the height of colonial times?
Well, I think I'll take a step. Native people from different countries, as I mentioned earlier, we have a common history of colonialism. We have common aspirations. We have common value systems, even though very diverse. I think we share, a strong love for the ancestors and for connections to the land and animals and plants. And we need to support one another, and I think the other aspect here is this United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which lays out a human rights framework for Indigenous peoples worldwide, and there are a number of very important human rights at stake on this struggle. And just like Standing Rock, it galvanized all of Native America to take a stand, that we drew a line and we took a stand. And it seems to me that this Carmichael mind is possibly another situation here in this part of the world where the Native people are going to have to support each other and take a stand. Mm-hmm. For Mother Earth and for our Aboriginal ways of life, So I hope that all Aboriginals people will support this effort and stand with the protectors here that are fighting with all of their might to protect this area, and also to realize that they're fighting for you and me, including non-Aboriginal Australians as well. They're fighting for everybody, and so they're entitled to and deserve the respect and the support of everyone, all human beings.
Because nobody can drink dirty water.
Yes, that's true. Or dirty air. Yeah, dirty air. Yeah.
I think if you breathe air and you drink water, this is your issue, and it's something that we all need to get behind because. If it's not us, then who? And we need to be supporting each other all the way. And I think just having that common history, but also having that common relationality to country and to the earth and our environment puts us on the same page anyway. Mm. And it's about what we do with that and how we build those relationships.
Definitely. And a great way to finish the program this morning. Big thanks for the both of yous for joining us on the program this morning. And if I could just add my little two cents in Always gotta. It is my show. No, again. And that's one of the things, you know, like, you know, as Indigenous peoples in this time today, you know, there's sort of two platforms where, you know, we link up. One is, you know, being traditional and being people who inherently belong to the land, but then also who, I guess, inherit, you know, the bad things from colonialism. It links us up and it makes us even more powerful and makes us even more, you know, stronger when we, you know, do what, you know, we're doing and what you fellows are doing, you know, linking up in internationally to bring our struggles together. I just want to say a big thank you for this mob for joining us on the program this morning. You can check out this program on our website at 98.9 FM, or you can go and listen to 98.9 FM for the repeat at 7 p.m. tonight. Big thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk.